going to begin. Now, we've been talking about signaling, and the last time we talked about it was before the exam and before break, so that's the distant past. So I want to bring people up to where we are, sort of recap the story so far, and then continue where we were. So in a way, what you want to look at is the Big Bang handout, and that's actually 14A. And that illustrates the principle that there are really two kinds of signaling molecules. There's the water-soluble ones and the lipid-soluble ones. And in your picture, the lipid-soluble ones are symbolized by a triangle and the water-soluble by a dot. So these are released in different ways, and their receptors are in different places. That lipid-soluble hormones and signal molecules can enter cells and bind to intracellular receptors. So that's diagrammed on the right of your handout, that they have intracellular receptors, although they travel through the blood attached to a carrier protein because they're not soluble, a small amount of them diffuses off and across the membrane into cells and binds to its receptor. And the receptors are almost always transcription factors. Which means that the transcription factor with receptor is now going to bind to the appropriate target regulatory region or cis-acting regulatory region on the DNA. Now, remember we said one of the big things with signaling is how do you get amplification? From a small amount of signal, how do you get a big bang? So in this case, the signal binds to a transcription factor, that triggers transcription, you make many copies of the message, they are translated, you make many copies of the protein, and you get a lot of result. So transcription is the amplifier here. So, but in order to have transcription, the receptor bound to its ligand has to bind to a region, a regulatory region, and these are usually called, if we're talking about hormones being the signals, these are called hormone response elements, or HREs. The point is these are cis-acting factors. And any particular signal molecule often turns on the transcription of many different genes. Now, how is this possible? Dr. Heiklin talked about the idea that many different genes will have similar regulatory regions, either in front or the other direction, but that there will be regulatory regions shared in common by many different genes. The same sequence is repeated in many different places. And as a result, a single signal is capable of turning on more than one gene. And this is an example of coordinate control. Now, we went through last time a little bit about the steps of how the intracellular receptor binds to its ligand, the receptors dimerize, they bind to their target on the DNA, that triggers transcription, or in some cases, inhibits transcription of the target gene. And I thought it would be clearer if we did an actual example. And so I want to talk about a specific hormone which signals in this way and a specific example. And the hormone that I want to talk about is estrogen. Estrogen is known to have many different effects on many different cell types, all through binding to a transcription factor receptor which either inhibits or activates transcription. And estrogen has many effects, but many of the effects it has are through controlling the production of receptors for other hormones. So adding estrogen either causes or upregulates the synthesis of a receptor, or in another cell type, it may downregulate the transcription of other or the same receptor. So the example I want to talk about are the effects that estrogen has on the uterus and the breast during pregnancy. Estrogen is fairly high during pregnancy, and it actually stimulates the receptors for oxytocin, a hormone. And in the uterus, it upregulates these receptors. It triggers reception, it triggers transcription of the gene for these receptors. So the uterus has more oxytocin receptors as a result of the estrogen. In the breast, however, instead of affecting the oxytocin receptors, it affects the receptors for prolactin, a different hormone. And it, in fact, inhibits transcription of the gene for prolactin receptors, so it downregulates these receptors. Now, what is the rationale behind here? Why has this combination been selected for? Oxytocin is what triggers the contractions of pregnancy, the contractions that lead to birth. So the uterus has to have receptors, so when the oxytocin comes along, you'll get enough contractions and the baby can be born. Prolactin, on the other hand, triggers the production of milk. And it doesn't pay to make milk until there's a baby to drink it. So the receptors for prolactin are in fact not present in the breast until after birth. After birth, the estrogen level falls, the inhibition is removed, prolactin receptors are made, and then the prolactin that is received causes the production of milk. Now, you may be aware that both of these hormones affect lactation, but in a different way, that prolactin is responsible for making milk. Oxytocin controls contractions, not just of the uterus, but after birth of the breast and the ejection of milk. But of course, you can't eject it if you don't have it. So, this is required for contractions for birth, obviously, while prolactin for milk production. Now, how is it possible that the same hormone affects the production, affects essentially two different genes, the gene for prolactin receptors in one cell and the gene for oxytocin receptors in another cell, and also it activates one and inhibits the other. So how is this possible? Well, there must be some difference in these two cell types. Dr. Heitland talked about the idea that different cell types are specialized in different ways, and they turn on different genes and make different proteins. So what's the difference? Well, it could be the differences in the receptors, but in fact it isn't. The receptor in both of these is exactly the same. It's the same transcription factor. And we know that the DNA is the same in both of these. So it isn't the cis-acting factors that are different. Or they're the same. It's the trans-acting factors, the regulatory proteins, are different in these two cases. Now, of course, it's not just the regulatory proteins. These two are specialized in different ways. They make a different set, not just of regulatory proteins, but of enzymes, structural proteins, receptors, the works. But in this case, probably the big difference is the regulatory proteins. Now, why does that matter? Both the gene for each type of receptor has an estrogen response element in front of it. But you may remember from what Dr. Heitland said that there isn't one regulatory sequence here. The regulatory sequence doesn't bind just one factor. It binds a series of factors. And what happens in terms of transcription depends not on the binding of one factor, but the binding of the combination. And although the estrogen receptor is the same in both of these cell types, the other proteins that bind to the regulatory sequences are different in the two different types. So the combination available to bind in front of the prolactin receptor gene is different than the collection available to bind in front of the oxytocin receptor gene. And in addition, the series of binding sites in front of one gene is different from the series of binding sites in front of the other. So it's this combinatorial system that makes up the difference. Now we will see many examples as we go of how the same hormone produces different responses in different tissues, and we'll discuss several reasons about how that happens. But the bottom line is always the same. Although the signal molecule and the trigger are the same, the proteins in the target cells are different. And whether it's the receptors that are different, the transcription factors that are different, the cofactors that are different, or the enzymes that are different, it's the difference in the proteins in the target that makes for the different response. Now, I would like to move on to the other type of receptor, the other type of signal and its receptors. So let me ask first if there are questions about this estrogen business or related. Yes?
For a woman that doesn't produce enough estrogen, is she still going to produce prolactin, and thus is she still producing?
She wants to know about what happens to a person who doesn't make enough estrogen. And I don't know the answer to that. Presumably, hormones work in very small amounts. So how much it takes to do this, I don't know. Okay, so if we now go back to our big picture, the Big Bang model, we want to look at the bottom of the handout. Because you notice at the very bottom, it has about the two kinds of signals, the water-soluble and the lipid-soluble. This is 14A. And it has the lipids, these, and then it has the receptors. We've already said that the receptors for lipid-soluble components are intracellular, and they're virtually all transcription factors. But for water-soluble signal molecules, water-soluble molecules cannot pass membranes unless there are transporters. So water-soluble signals do not simply diffuse into cells. They have to bind to receptors on the surface of the cell. So that's why in the upper picture above it, we have something that looks sort of like this. When the ligand comes along, it binds to the extracellular domain of the transmembrane surface receptor, causes a change in the conformation of the intracellular domain, and that's what triggers events to happen in the cell. Now, so all of these receptors are transmembrane, and they're on the cell surface. But depending on the type of ligand, there are actually three categories of cell surface receptors. And they're all written here. One is a channel. One is a G-protein coupled receptor. And one is what I've called here a protein kinase linked receptor. Now, we're going to concentrate on the middle case for now. But let me explain what these are. Sometimes the receptor is itself a channel, and as diagrammed above on this handout, one of the ways you get a big bang is you open the channel, and that causes more ions to flow, and that opens voltage-gated channels, and you get a big difference. And Dr. Feierstein is going to talk next week about channels, nerve conduction, etc., how you get a big bang out of a receptor that is also a channel. But many receptors are not channels. The receptors themselves just pick up the signal, then they convey through this change in their intracellular domain, they convey the change or the signal to an intracellular component, which in turn causes an event. Now, the proteins that are linked to G, the receptors that are linked to G proteins, are a very important class. You might ask, Where did G proteins? What the hell are G proteins? G proteins are important because they're a very special class of proteins that act as a switch. They are turned on and then they by something, such as the receptor. And then they turn themselves off without any other input. So they're used in many, many processes as a kind of switch. We've been ignoring them up to now, but they're actually very important. We're going to concentrate on their role in signaling, but they're involved in many other places, and if you've been reading, you've probably come upon them. Now, this receptor activates a G protein, and we'll explain what that is in a little bit. And the G protein, in turn, can open a channel, but usually that's not what it does. Usually what the G protein does in its switch capacity is to turn on an enzyme, usually. And this enzyme generates a small molecule inside the cell. So this enzyme catalyzes something, and I'll just call it X to Y. And now this compound Y is able to diffuse through the cell, hit all of its targets, activate them, and start an amplification series. Now, people refer to Y as a second messenger. Now, why is that? The signal is referred to as the first messenger. The ligand, the hormone, the whatever it is, but it's on the outside of the cell. If it gets inside, like with EGF, it's just going to go to lysosomes and get degraded. So it's basically not going to do anything else but bind to the receptor. So that's the first messenger. But what actually inside the cell kicks in action and kicks in amplification is this molecule here. So it's called the second messenger. That all this process in between is referred to often as signal transduction, how you get the signal from the outside to the inside. So one way to do that is this first messenger is a G protein coupled receptor. It activates a G protein, which activates an enzyme, which gives you something inside the cell, which can now diffuse around and cause some action. Now, what we're going to do today, when we finish talking about this other class briefly, is we're going to come back and look first at G-protein-coupled receptors a little more closely, then at G-proteins, and then at second messengers and how you get them. But before we do that, what about this third class of receptors? Now, this is quite a heterogeneous class, but what almost all of them are is that this domain here either is a kinase or it activates a kinase. So that's why they're called kinase linked. And remember, a kinase adds phosphates. And what does a kinase add phosphates to? It's the side chains. These are protein kinases. So they add phosphates to the side chains of the appropriate amino acids. So if you now look at 14B, we have here a picture of a typical G protein coupled receptor. All the G protein coupled receptors belong to the same protein family. They are all 7-pass proteins. So this is the bilayer of lipid on the outside of the cell. Here's the outside, here's the inside. And all the G proteins are 7-pass proteins that look sort of the same way, something like that. And the amino end is always here, the carboxyl end is always here inside the cell. So all these receptors are multi-pass, and this part is what binds the G protein. Now, in contrast, these protein kinase-linked receptors are almost all single pass. So this is a GPCR, a G-protein-coupled receptor. Now remember, this is not the G-protein. This is the receptor which is going to bind to and activate a G-protein, but the G-protein is separate. This is just the receptor. So the ligand binds somewhere out here. We haven't said where. Now, by contrast, if I draw the bilayer on the outside of the cell, protein kinase-linked receptors are almost all single pass. So they look something like this. And again, when they bind their ligand, there is a change in the intracellular domain, which this is itself a kinase and becomes activated, or it binds to a kinase which becomes activated. Now, remember, the whole point of all of this is to get a big response. Remember, amplification. So one kind of amplification is the G protein activates an enzyme which makes a second messenger which activates somebody else, etc., etc. Now, with these protein kinase-linked receptors, there isn't always a second messenger. There is sometimes. But sometimes all that happens is this kinase adds phosphates to another protein, which in turn adds them to another protein. And of course, at each step, one molecule of enzyme modifies many molecules of target, each of which modifies many molecules of the next target, and you get a big amplification. You don't get it through a second messenger, but both of these give you a big amplification. Now, without going into the details, with G-protein-coupled receptors, usually the result of all the second messenger business is to activate a pre-existing protein, usually. If we look at our lipid-soluble case, if we have a lipid-soluble ligand, what do? Well, we activate a pre-existing protein, but that's a transcription factor. So that leads to the synthesis of new proteins. So there's the ultimate target here has to be made. The ultimate target, usually, in the case of a G-protein-linked coupled receptor, does not have to be made. It only has to be activated. And with these single-pass receptors, it varies what happens. Now, just one more piece. We're not going to talk at length about these single-pass protein kinase receptors until we get to the very end of the class and we talk about cancer. And the reason for that is that this kind of receptor is usually involved in controlling growth. That is, the kinds of signal molecules that use these receptors are usually, but not always, growth factors. On the other hand, many, although not all, hormones of the water-soluble type, which means, well, just we'll say water-soluble hormones, tend to use G-protein-coupled receptors. And we'll do some examples of those. We probably won't get to it today, but we'll do examples of this next time. Some specific hormones and what they trigger. All right. So if you have a water-soluble signal, then it has to bind to a surface, cell surface receptor, and that receptor is either itself a channel, or it's linked to a G protein, or it's a protein kinase linked receptor. One of these. Now, as we said, Dr. Feierstein's going to talk about these. We'll talk about the protein kinases when we get to growth and cancer, which is growth gone bad. And we're going to concentrate on the G protein coupled receptors, which in a way makes sense because there are a huge number of them and they are of great importance. Many, many of the drugs on the market today interfere either with these receptors or the G proteins or further down the line in the process. So we want to take a better look at them. Now, I think we've said enough about the receptor itself. And now we want to talk about the G protein part, but that's on the same handout. That's on B. So once the G protein coupled receptor changes conformation in this area, this will then, this changed shape will bind to a G protein, and the G protein will become activated. And what we want to talk now is about how G proteins get activated. And before we do the pictures on the handout, we want to do a simpler version. We said that G proteins act as a switch. That is, they exist in a form that has GDP on them and a form that has GTP. This is the active form. This is the inactive. Now, what do we mean by a switch? If you convert the protein to the form with GTP, it becomes active, and it either activates or inhibits the appropriate target. In other words, something happens. But remember, we said this is a switch. So spontaneously, they in fact revert. To do this part, to activate, requires some other protein to trigger the activation, such as an activated receptor. But to inactivate does not require another protein. The inactivation happens because of an enzyme activity that is a part of the G protein itself. Now, getting from the GTP version to the GDP version, all you have to do is knock off a phosphate. And if you look at the actual picture that you have on your handout, it draws the G protein a little more complicated because most G proteins, the ones involved in signaling and many others, are trimeric. They have three parts. And these three subunits are known as alpha, beta, and gamma, and they're labeled on your handout. And in the inactive form, all three of them stick together, and GDP is bound to the alpha part. Now, to activate it, you would think you would just phosphorylate the GDP and get yourself GTP. But that is not the way it works. The way it works is called nucleotide exchange, or guanine nucleotide exchange. The way it works is that the GDP actually falls off. And the alpha gets a fresh new GTP. So you put in GTP, and it bumps the GDP. So the GDP falls off, and a new GTP comes in. That's why this is called exchange, which is different from what a kinase does. What does a kinase do? A kinase adds a phosphate, but always from ATP. So it's worth maybe drawing by comparison, if this is exchange, what does a kinase look like? And that board's getting sort of cluttered, so let's try this one. So what would happen with a kinase is you'd have some protein, and you would add a phosphate to it. And by definition, a kinase adds the phosphate from ATP, so you would put it in ATP and get an ADP out because its phosphate had been transferred. Now, both of these processes are reversible. That is, you can take the phosphate off using a phosphatase. So the net result of one cycle is that you hydrolyze ATP. Well, what's the net result of one cycle here? Once you get to the GTP stage, how do you get back to the GDP stage? In that case, you actually do it by losing a phosphate, and in this case, maybe I'll make it pink to make it clearer. So what's the net result of one cycle? You put in a GTP, you had a GDP and a GTP, and you got out of GDP. And then the GTP went back to GDP and PI. So the net result of a cycle, actually, is the GTP ended up hydrolyzed. Just like the net result over there is ATP ended up hydrolyzed. But the difference is, here, the ATP is always completely separate. It gives its phosphate away, then that phosphate's released. It gives its phosphate away, that phosphate's released. But here it's a different setup. Here the GDP in the the GTP is free, and then it binds to the protein itself, loses a phosphate, and the GDP you get back is really on a protein. So you start with free GTP and put it on a protein. Knock off a phosphate while it's still on the protein, and now you have GDP stuck to the protein. But the net result is for one cycle of going from inactive protein to active protein and back again, you blew one high-energy phosphate to do one cycle. So this is an example where the energy of ATP or GTP is not being used to drive a synthesis with a positive delta G. It's being used instead for regulatory purposes. Hydrolyzing ATP or GTP has changed the state of your enzyme or your protein, so it's now active, and then it goes back again. Now, in both of these cases, the active form can be either an activator or an inhibitor. That is, it does something, but what it does may be to squelch a process or to promote it. Now, we left something out of our picture here. When you put GTP on the alpha subunit, the alpha subunit comes away. So as it shows on your handout, the beta and the gamma are left stuck together. And when the phosphate is hydrolyzed off the GTP to give you back GDP, then the two parts get back together again. Now, to carry out one cycle with a kinase, how many enzymes do you need? Maybe I should say how many proteins. How many proteins does this picture represent? Three. Because there's the target protein, the kinase to put the phosphate on, and the phosphatase to get it off. How many proteins does this represent? Well, we actually left one off. Because you need something to trigger this activation. Something like an activated receptor. And this has multiple names. Sometimes it's called a GEF, or it could be a G-protein-coupled receptor. A G-protein-coupled receptor is an example of a guanine nucleotide exchange factor. So you need something to trigger the exchange of GTP for GDP. And that exchange factor can be a G-protein-coupled receptor or something else if we're not talking about signaling. All right. So now that we got that in the picture, how many proteins are represented here? Notice it's only two this time because the catalytic phosphatase is part of the G-protein itself. So to turn it on, you need something. To turn that on, you need something. But to turn that one off, you need a phosphatase. Here, you do not need that. The G protein itself turns itself off. Now, there are other proteins which can slow down or accelerate this process. But without them, the protein will turn itself off anyway. You don't need a phosphatase to get rid of the phosphate. Okay. So this illustrates the switch capacity of a G protein. How, though, does this G protein do anything? Well, on your handout, actually, in the middle of B, is a summary or a representation of the role, typical role, of a G protein, and it's written in your notes in words. And the idea is that you start out with a receptor and a ligand, And the receptor here is a G protein coupled receptor. And the ligand, which can be a hormone or something else, comes along. And this receptor, of course, is sitting in the membrane. So they get it together and they form a complex. Now that gives you an active receptor in the membrane. Now in this picture, we didn't draw it actually changing conformation the way we did in the picture underneath, where we showed the receptor going from this state to this one. But when the ligand binds, that activates the receptor, and that in turn activates the G protein, which is embedded in the membrane. So this is the G protein coupled receptor. And that activates the G protein. Now, while the G protein is active, it then affects the next guy in line, which varies. But this is usually an enzyme, and the one written there, adenyl cyclase, is the most famous example. But it affects some enzyme, and remember that enzyme converts X to Y, and Y is our so-called second messenger inside the cell. Now, before we leave the G protein business, we said there's more than one possible target here. So there's more than one type of G protein. There's the G protein, and in addition to that, some G proteins activate their target, and some G proteins inhibit their target. So there are multiple G proteins, depending on what the target enzyme is, and whether they inhibit it or whether they activate it. And there are different terminologies in different books used for the various G proteins. Today we're going to talk mostly about the G protein, which activates the enzyme adenyl or adenylyl, depending on your terminology, cyclase. But there's another G protein that inhibits this enzyme and additional G proteins that affect other enzymes. Now, I just want to mention as an aside that most G proteins are trimeric, like this. But there is a class of G proteins known as small G proteins that have no subunits. They're just called small G proteins, and they're very important in the control of growth. We're not going to talk about them very much. And the big difference is that generally they are not activated by receptors. There has to be a middleman in there somewhere. And of course they don't come apart because they only have one subunit. But they are similar, large or small, in that they have a GDP-bound inactive version and a GTP-bound active version. Now, as there's one thing I see we forgot to say, that here you have two parts of the trimeric G protein. Which of them is the part that's going to activate something or cause some action? And the answer is one or the other or both. Sometimes this is the part, the alpha, that binds to the target protein and activates or inhibits it. Sometimes it is the beta-gamma combination that binds to the target and activates it or inhibits it. And in some cases, each of these has a different target. So there are some problems like this in the problem book where the alpha activates or inhibits one enzyme and the beta gamma another. But in any case, after a short time, the enzyme itself, that is the G protein, has an enzymatic activity that hydrolyzes the GTP to GDP, puts the parts back together again, and shuts itself off, and whatever it was triggering stops. Now, I see the only thing that perhaps I didn't say here is that because the net result of a G protein, one cycle, is to hydrolyze GTP, G proteins are sometimes known as GTP ACEs because the net effect of their action is to hydrolyze GTP. Just as the net result of this cycle is to hydrolyze ATP for a kinase plus a phosphatase. Now, I think that's it, what I wanted to say about G proteins and their receptors. So let me ask what questions people have before we go on. Yeah?
You said that the G protein is embedded in the membrane.
Mm-hmm.
So does it all come apart and all leave the membrane when it's activated, and then all come back and go into the membrane once deactivated?
The question is, where does this go? Does it leave the membrane or does it stay? And I think it leaves, but I honestly don't remember. It's explained, I think, in the books and in the problem set, but I don't remember. Other questions? It may also depend on which G protein it is. Yeah?
Does the energy from splitting GTP go towards anything?
Does the energy from splitting GTP go toward anything? Well, in the sense of driving something with a positive delta G, it doesn't go anywhere. But from the point of view of activating a switch, it most definitely does. So the energy has essentially been used to flip the switch and to activate the G protein, which then does something. Yeah. Why GTP, not ATP? Now, this, I think, has an evolutionary answer. Of course, the usual answer is this is the way it is. But it appears that certain proteins have evolved which use GTP in this manner, and other proteins have evolved which use ATP in this manner. And the assumption is that once this happened to one protein, then many variants of it have arisen. And once this capacity arose, many variants of this one have arisen. And so that's just the way it is. So the answer lies in the evolutionary history. There doesn't seem to be anything about GTP that makes it more fit for this job and ATP for that job. Now, I wanted to move on now and look more closely at this second messenger part. What are these compounds and how are they generated? So we're assuming that the receptor binds the ligand, activates the receptor, activates the G protein. Now the G protein activates its target, and you get a second messenger. Now there are three famous second messengers, and they are actually written in your notes more thoroughly. The most famous one is cyclic AMP. That's the one we're going to focus on the most. But another almost as famous one is actually a combination, which is called DAG plus IP3. And the final one is calcium. Now, cyclic AMP is derived from ATP, and we'll discuss the structure in a minute. It's actually on your handout. DAG plus IP3 are derived from a membrane lipid. The reason they're always written here as a combination is that the membrane lipid is split into two, and these are the two halves that you get. So when you get one, you always get the other. Now, in this case, it's known that IP3 is soluble, and DAG stays in the membrane. Another time, when we hit a system that actually uses this second messenger, we will discuss its structure and how it is generated. The critical thing is one enzyme called adenyl or adenyl cyclase converts ATP to cyclic AMP. A different enzyme, whose name is listed here, but it's a lipase, splits a phospholipid in the membrane to give you these two. So which of these you get depends on which G protein you activate, and therefore which target enzyme is activated, and therefore which second messenger. So some hormones or enzymes trigger the G protein that activates adenyl cyclase, usually abbreviated AC, and you get cyclic AMP. Other enzymes have receptors that activate a different G protein, activates a different enzyme, and you get DAG and IP3. Now, we've mentioned before the calcium is normally very low in the cell, and a spike of calcium is used as a signal to do things like cause the fusion of secretory vesicles with the membrane. It's a stimulus for secretion, among other things. So calcium moving through the cytoplasm, or IP3, or cyclic AMP, are all considered second messengers. Now, where does the calcium come from? The calcium can come from outside the cell because channels are open. Or the calcium can come from inside the cell. And one of the major ways it does that, and well, we haven't discussed the details at all, is that this second messenger, IP3, causes the release of internal calcium from stores. That in normal cells, calcium is stored in the ER. So the ER has high calcium. IP3 and other signals cause the opening of channels so that the calcium enters the cytoplasm. This is a brief pulse and acts as a signal. Now, if what I said is right, the second messenger IP3 actually triggers the pulse of calcium. And for that reason, some people refer to calcium as a third messenger, because strictly speaking, the ligand on the outside activates a G-protein coupled receptor, which activates a G-protein, which activates an enzyme, which gives you IP3. And then the IP3 moves through the cell and causes the release of calcium. So some people refer to calcium as a third messenger. But the point is that these three things that I've written here, cyclic AMP, IP3, and calcium, are small molecules, even in one case an ion, that diffuse through the cell and carry information and act as messengers. And what do these do? All of these bind to target proteins and activate them. And that may be stoichiometric, one for one, but you get a lot of these small molecules. Each molecule binds to one target, but then that target is an enzyme which modifies many others, which starts an amplification. Okay. So what I would like to do is to concentrate then on the cyclic AMP business and the enzyme that generates it. And this is the example shown on your handout. So we want to go back and look again at the handout. So we're talking about B. And you see that picture in the middle of B looks very much like what I've got up here, except this is adenyl cyclase. You start with ATP and you make cyclic AMP. Okay. Now, what is cyclic AMP? So if you look at the bottom of the handout, you will see that we have drawn out the relation. Well, I didn't draw out ATP because hopefully by now everybody knows what it looks like, but I've drawn out cyclic AMP. So AMP means it's ribose with an A, and it's a monophosphate. So it has only one phosphate, but it's cyclic in that the phosphate, remember, is P double bond O, and then it has one O, which is ionized, and then it's linked to two hydroxyls. So it's linked to two different carbons. It's linked here also. So this would be a carbon. And then there would be... No, I didn't write it right. Like this. So there used to be... This is ribose, not deoxyribose. So there was an OH here and an OH here. And there was an OH here. There was a 2 prime, a 3 prime, and a 5 prime. Now the phosphate is linked to the 5 prime hydroxyl and to the 3 prime hydroxyl. Now in ATP, what's the difference? In ATP, you would have had 3 phosphates off the end of the 5 prime. You've lost 2 of them. But the remaining phosphate now has linked to the 3 prime. That's what makes it cyclic. Now, adenyl cyclase, we wrote AC on the handout, is the enzyme that converts ATP to cyclic AMP. Now, how do you turn off a signal? We said one of the big deals with a G protein is even though it's activated by a G protein coupled receptor or some other exchange factor, after a short time it hydrolyzes its own phosphate off and it becomes inactive. So we get a jolt from the ligand. That activates the G protein. That activates adenyl cyclase. That causes you to make cyclic AMP. But what turns that off? Because the cyclic AMP is just there, doing its thing. Well, just as there is an enzyme that catalyzes production of cyclic AMP, there is another enzyme that hydrolyzes cyclic AMP. It breaks the bond here and converts it into ordinary 5' adenosine monophosphate, or ordinary AMP. And that is called phosphodiesterase, or PDE. And that's written on the bottom of your handout. So that, strictly speaking, what we've written here is the turn-on process. The turn-off process, of course, is that the G protein inactivates itself and that cyclic AMP is destroyed by phosphodiesterase. So the importance of this is that the signal really acts like a signal. I tell you, you tell the next guy, or maybe it's like dominoes or a chain of telephone. Who has telephones anymore? You text all the time, right? But anyway, the point is that this person tells this person, maybe it's Twitter, and this person tells that person, and this person tells that person, and this tells that person, but then it goes off. And it goes off because there's no more input into the chain. But there's something I didn't tell you. What good is cyclic AMP anyway? Big deal. Okay. So we need one more piece to this picture, which is what do you do with the cyclic AMP? And that is actually written on your handout, and I'm going to clean up my picture a little to convert it into your handout. There are two arrows here. Does not mean there are two steps, just that it should really be like this, meaning that cyclic AMP goes to many parts of the cytoplasm. But it always does the same thing. It binds to and activates an enzyme called protein kinase A. This enzyme has other names as well, but it's usually, but not always, called PKA. So you might say that the point of all this is to activate protein kinase A. But where does that get you? Big deal again. Now, it is true that a little bit of signal will get you a lot of active protein kinase A. But the real point now is the final target. What enzyme or protein in the cell is going to be turned on or turned off? Some protein in the cell is going to be modified so that it works better or it works worse. That is the final target of all of this. And so I just put that on the bottom. I wrote adds phosphate to protein. And those proteins are the target of this entire process. Now, what's going to happen in a particular cell is going to depend on what proteins are available to be phosphorylated. Only some proteins are phosphorylated by protein kinase A, not every protein. And each cell type has a different collection of proteins which can be phosphorylated by protein kinase A. Now, as we've indicated before, when you activate a protein, you can make it, that is, when you modify a protein, I should say, when you modify a protein, sometimes you activate it, sometimes you inactivate it. And some of the targets are activated and some are inactivated. Now, the classic way this was all discovered was the response to the hormone epinephrine or adrenaline, which causes the breakdown of glycogen. And I deliberately did not put any of the details of that on the handout because it's incredibly complicated. The basic idea is that the hormone binds to a G protein coupled receptor, which hits a G protein, which hits adenyl cyclase, which causes you to make cyclic AMP, which activates protein kinase A. And then this phosphorylates many of the enzymes involved in energy metabolism. In particular, the enzymes involved either in breaking down glycogen so that you can use the glucose for energy metabolism, or the enzymes that build up glycogen. It phosphorylates a lot of these enzymes. It activates one set and inactivates the other. So the net result is you break down glycogen and you release glucose. But in order to make this work, you have to not only activate the right enzymes to do what you want, but you have to inhibit the enzymes that do the opposite so you don't just get a cycle which is fruitless. And the whole system is pretty complicated, and we may or may not talk about it later. There are some problems in the problem book, and there is a link to an actual diagram of all the pathways so you can see it. But I wanted to talk about one other example. But before I do that, I have to add one more wrinkle to this. That in a cell, remember, for this cycle to modify proteins reversibly, you need both kinases and phosphatases. So cells contain not only protein kinase A, which adds phosphates to proteins and alters their activity, but it contains phosphatases, which take those phosphates off and return the proteins to their previous state, activating some, inactivating others. And so in general, when the cyclic AMP is high, the protein kinases, the protein kinase A is active and the phosphatases are not. When cyclic AMP is low, it is reversed. The kinase doesn't work, but then the phosphatases are active. Now, what is an example, actually a simpler example, which is written in your notes, of how all of this works? One of the hormones that uses this system is thyroid-stimulating hormone, often called TSH. It has other names as well. Now, this stimulates the thyroid. The thyroid has, this is a protein. Thyroid hormone is a lipid. But this is a protein that stimulates the thyroid to make thyroid hormone. So this protein binds to a G-protein-coupled receptor on the surface of the thyroid, activates a G-protein, activates adenyl cyclase, you get cyclic AMP, and you activate protein kinase A. But now, what happens? What's the point of all this, so to speak? To get the thyroid to make thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is lipid-soluble. So can you store it? No, you can't. You have to make it when you need it. So what protein kinase A does is to phosphorylate and activate the enzymes that make thyroid hormone. So the net result of all of this is to activate a bunch of pre-existing enzymes. They synthesize thyroid hormone, which is released. Then thyroid hormone, being lipid-soluble, acts the way estrogen does, binds to a transcription factor receptor, triggers transcription, etc. Okay. So let me stop here and ask what questions people have about this part, about the second messenger cyclic AMP part, before we go on. Yeah?
Did you say that certain G-protein receptors will trigger phosphatase instead of kinase, or is it not that
right? His G-protein coupled receptors can trigger the production or the inhibition of the production of cyclic AMP. Okay. That's correct. But the effect on phosphatase versus kinase is due to the cyclic AMP level, not directly to the G-protein.
And all cyclic AMPs trigger kinase.
What cyclic AMP does, remember it's a small molecule, it's not a protein, has no choice, does only one thing. Cyclic AMP binds to protein kinase A and activates it, stoichiometric. Okay, and whether cyclic AMP directly inhibits the phosphatases, I don't know, or whether it's indirect. Yeah?
When you, so for lipid-soluble hormones, you have to make it when you need it, but what happens to the hormones already generated and out there attaching to receptors? Do they eventually...
What happens to lipid-soluble hormones once you've made them and let them go? They are either degraded. I think that's the answer, that hormones are made generally in minute quantities anyway. And if they don't, the question is what happens to them to turn them off? And I think the answer is they're degraded. Yeah.
The protein kinase A itself, is
this
also just degraded, or is
that just degraded? Does protein kinase A get degraded? No. Protein kinase A is present in most, if not all, cells, as far as I know, and it's there all the time. But the question is it working or not? So if the cyclic AMP in the cell is high, then protein kinase A is working. And if cyclic AMP is low, then protein kinase doesn't work. So if you turn off this, if you destroy the cyclic AMP, then it, whatever you have tends to fall off the protein kinase A, and the protein kinase A doesn't work anymore. So you don't need to degrade the protein kinase A. Yeah?
What determines the set of proteins available to protein kinase A?
What determines the set of proteins available to protein kinase A? Protein kinase A, like any enzyme, has some specificity. So there's some sequence of amino acids that have to be in that protein. What that exactly is, I don't know. So only proteins that have that particular recognition site will get phosphorylated by protein kinase A. Okay. So we've talked a good bit about signaling here, and I want to talk a little bit about what you need it for. Now, it's pretty obvious from the things that Dr. Heitland was talking about that when you're building a multicellular organism, you have to have some kind of signaling. So you have to tell cells which way to go, et cetera, coordinate with your neighbors, and so on. But I want to talk about how you use signaling in an adult organism such as yourself. That this is what is usually called physiology. The question of how you coordinate the various parts. Once you get them all made and put in the right place, you still have to coordinate them. And so the question is, how do you do that? So that's what signaling is really for. And I want to talk a little bit about how multicellular organisms operate once they are built. So we see a little better where the signaling fits in. Now, we've talked a lot already about single-celled organisms, yeast, bacteria. They can be eukaryotic like yeast or bacterial. But in any case, when you talk about a unicellular organism, you could ask, and this table is in your notes, what surrounds the cell? And the answer, of course, is whatever it happens to be floating in, the external environment. But what if you have a multicellular organism? In a multicellular organism, such as yourself, what surrounds most of the cells? It's not the outside. It's the intracellular fluid. It's the extracellular fluid or the blood. It is the materials making up your body, the internal materials that surround it. So the internal environment surrounds each cell. People sometimes call it the internal milieu, meaning the makeup of what's inside. Now, what do we really mean by the internal environment? We have talked about people usually divide the extracellular fluid, that is the stuff in between cells or outside of cells, into what we've called the interstitial fluid and the stuff in the blood, the liquid part of the blood or the plasma. So the extracellular fluid, some of it is just in the spaces between cells. That's the interstitial fluid we talked about when we talked about epithelial cells. And some of it is the liquid in the plasma, the liquid in the blood, so-called plasma. So some part of the ECF surrounds virtually every cell. Now, can this organism regulate the environment that surrounds the cell. A unicellular organism cannot control what is outside it. It can control what it takes up, it can control what's inside the cell, but it cannot control what's outside it. Can you control the makeup of the materials surrounding your cells? Yeah, you can. That a whole part, in fact, of your operation, the whole point, one of the major functions of a multicellular organism is to maintain a more or less constant internal makeup. So your internal, your extracellular fluid is kept about the same from time to time. Now, how do you do that? In order to do that, you have to ask, how many functions does a cell have? What is it? What's the job of a cell? From the point of view of a unicellular organism, the basic job is to grow, and that's it. But what about your cells? Do they just grow? Well, first of all, if they all just grew, you'd be dead. And if some of them do it out of control, that's cancer. So clearly, but on the other hand, if they didn't grow, your wounds wouldn't heal. When your skin peeled off, you'd be raw, etc., etc. So obviously, some at least of your cells have to grow. But they have to do something else. In addition to growing, they have to contribute to the maintenance of the whole organism. So usually they contribute to maintaining a constant internal environment as well. They have two jobs. Or sometimes more. And how does that work? Are the cells specialized? And with a unicellular, no, but with an yes. Almost every cell in your body has both a specialized function and a self-maintenance function. And it's the cooperation of all those maintenance functions and self-maintenance that allows you to go on. Now, how does it work? We've already said that the different kinds of specialized cells can be grouped into four or five different tissues. Depends whether you're a lumper or a splitter, whether you get four or five. That every cell type can be considered either muscle, nerve, connective, or epithelial. But what, in order for you to operate, those cell types have to be organized into larger groups. You all are well aware that you have organs, and the organs are organized into systems, and so forth. Now, what's the difference between a tissue and an organ? An organ consists of multiple tissue types cooperating together. And clearly the different cell types within have to communicate, and one organ has to communicate with another, and that's why you need signaling. Now, to give you an example, how do you put all of those various cell tissue types together to make an organ? Well, the example that is on 15B, I think, 15A. I'm sure that's the right one. Yes. Shows a sort of typical organ. Now, we've already talked about the idea that you have epithelial tissue lining your GI tract. Now, we've said many times it's not smooth like this, it's folded, but it looks something like this. Now, what that picture represents is what you'd get, not if you made a slice this way, but if you made a longitudinal slice this way, and you looked at the edge. Now, what you see at the top, what we're saying is you're looking at a slice, you've sliced it, and you're looking at all the layers that are out like this in the picture. So what you see at the top is just the slice of these cells, except remember they're folded, not straight. But then underneath that, you have connective tissue. That's what those little slash lines are on your picture. That's connective tissue. And then you have what look like little circles, but those are cross sections of longitude of circular muscle which goes around. This is all smooth muscle. You have smooth muscle that goes around this way. So when you slice it, you just see a little dot. But that's not all you have. Under that, you have longitudinal layers of muscle. You have muscle that actually goes this way. So you have muscle that can squeeze this way, and you have muscle that can shorten and lengthen this way. And then you have, under that, you have a layer of nerves and blood vessels. So I've just symbolized that by the colored paper, which is sort of clear. But then you have, you notice, more little dots. So under that, you have a layer, again, of circular muscle. I have spare circular muscles because some of these wear out. Okay. Huh? And then you notice underneath that you have more longitudinal muscle. Okay. And then under that, you have connective tissue because you have to connect the whole thing to the body wall. And that's partially what connective tissue does. Now, this is a sort of typical organ. And you notice it isn't just one cell type. And in fact, I picked this because it has all the tissue types in it. It has muscle, it has nerve, it has connective, it has blood vessels in it, which is, of course, a kind of connective or the fifth, depending on how you look at it, and it has epithelial. So what you're looking at in your handout is a slice that sort of goes this way, what you would see, and you would see each of these layers one at a time. And what you need signaling for, again, is for coordination of this with all the other organs and the various layers in it with itself. And I want to say one more thing about how you do this coordination. And the basic answer is that what is a lot of the signaling that keeps the extracellular fluid pretty much the same do? The process of keeping things about the same is called homeostasis. And it involves mostly negative feedback. Now, we've been talking about signaling. Signaling is sort of an example of positive feedback. A little bit of signal causes more signal, causes more signal, causes more signal until, boom, something happens. The classic example of positive feedback is not that somebody says something nice. That's what it means in English. It doesn't mean activation. That's what it means in biochemistry. But what it means in physiology is a little gives you more, boom. And the classic example is sexual arousal. A little bit causes more, which causes more, which causes more, until boom. Then you go back to zero and you start over again. So that's a classic example of positive feedback. But homeostasis is maintained by negative feedback. And the idea of negative feedback, again, it's not somebody says something nasty, and it's not just that you inhibit something. What it means is that when you get a deviation, you correct it. You negate the deviation. If it gets too hot, you cool it off. If it gets too cold, you warm it up. So you have what is called a regulated variable, something that you want to keep about constant, like the temperature or the glucose concentration in your blood or the sodium concentration in your blood. And if it gets too high, something corrects for it. And if it gets too low, usually, something corrects for it. Now, in some cases, you have only one kind of correction. In most parts of the world like ours, you need both an air conditioner and a heater. But if you live in the tropics, you only need one of them. And if you live in the Arctic, you only need the other one. So it depends on the cell type what kind of correction mode you have. But what is the result of having these correction modes? Will the blood glucose in your blood be exactly constant? It will, in fact, not. It will go like this. Because it will get a little too high, and that will be corrected. It will get a little low, that will be corrected. But all in all, it will vary around a fixed amount. Now, what we're going to do next time is we're going to explain how this works, the principles behind it, and look at a bunch of examples. And what we're going to do now is return the exams if you want to stay. If not, you can pick them up after the evening class. in the boxes outside my office. Now, if any TAs are here, Dr. Heichlin has come to help, and if there are any TAs here, we'd appreciate that too.